This is Audible.
Better Listen presents Power of Space, Part 1, with Alan Watts.
I suppose you may think it rather nervy of me to devote this whole seminar to talking about nothing. But it's about space. And in most people's minds, space is just nothing. Unless it's filled with air. But once you get outside the air, space may be in some way crossed by floating bodies, by various kinds of electrical vibrations, light waves, cosmic rays, etc. But since the Michelson-Morley experiment, which seemed to prove conclusively that there wasn't any such thing as ether, some kind of attenuated fluid through which light was propagated, space is just isn't there. It's a way we have, in other words, of talking about distances between bodies. In other words, when we say the distance between them increased, as if the distance were a substantive that does something, like the man walked, the distance increased. But I suppose what we are actually saying is that the two bodies we are talking about increased the distance between themselves. They did it. But then you suddenly find that you've got distance as an object. They increased the distance, now being the object of the verb, whereas before it was the substance, the subject. And so, at once one begins to see there's something fishy about space. And after all, it is the background against which we see everything. And even a blind person has a sense of space in that which does not obstruct motion. And yet, the funny thing about space is that in a way it doesn't end where a solid begins. You can shift a solid around in space without apparently altering it in any way. And after all, there is space between the two sides, shall we say, or ends of the solid. We can think of that in terms of space and measure it in terms of space. But it is against space that we experience everything that we experience. And by the way, also, we experience everything not only in the dimension of space, but also in the dimension of time. And the fascination about space and time is that while they are basic to all possible experiences that we have, you just can't put your finger on them. Space seems to be completely immaterial. And when St. Augustine was asked, "What is time?" he said, "I know what it is, but when you ask me, I don't." So these two basic dimensions of our physical world are uncommonly elusive. We could perhaps say that they are pure abstractions. There is no such thing as space, and there is no such thing as time. They are merely our way of measuring and thinking about the behavior of the physical universe as a pattern, a system of patterns, energy patterns. And if you measure the movement of these patterns, the line along which you measure motion is called the timeline. If you measure their positions, the line along which you measure their positions, you would call the space line. And these two lines would be as abstract as the equator in relation to longitude zero. These things don't exist on the physical face of the world. They are imaginary lines and are only to be found on maps. Could you also say that the same thing was true of time and space? We think, for example, that there are three coordinates of space and one of time. The three coordinates of space being length, breadth, and depth. And through that runs one of time. But come to think of it, it's rather artificial. It is making us think of space as having a sort of grain to it, as if it were a crystalline substance. And however transparent the crystal, it does have a grain. And space has the grain of up, across, and through. Those are the three ways in which we think of space. And we can't think of any more, not with our senses. We can mathematically conceive spaces with infinitely many dimensions. That is to say, you can write it down as if it were so, but you can't conceive it in your imagination. You can draw, it's great fun to draw, a four-dimensional cube having four spatial dimensions. It's called a tesseract. And it's a tesseract is a good word to apply to a person who is ultimately square. Four-dimensional square. But the tesseract, you see the minute you draw it, that obviously you can't have more than the three right angular dimensions of space, or the coordinates, in any kind of solid figure that you know. And so you can think about it in terms of mathematics, but you can't conceive more than these three coordinates sensuously. And so we begin, it's basic common sense to us that space has this structure. But of course, the question is this a structure of space, or is it a structure of the human nervous system, the human brain, and human thought, which is projected onto the external world as a tool for measuring it? This is one way of approaching the problem. But there's another way altogether, which is to consider space as anything but nothing. If space is basic to all that we experience, as time is, you might say then that space is as near as we can imagine to being the ground of the world, or what some people have called God. The texts of the Hindus, Buddhists, and Taoists are full of ways in which the symbol of space is used to mean the ultimate reality. Space is used in Indian, basic Indian philosophy, in Vedanta. It is called Akasha. And Akasha is for them the fundamental element. There are five elements: earth, water, air, and fire, and Akash. And so space contains all the other elements. In Buddhist philosophy, where the ultimate reality is called shunyata, the void, the Chinese will translate the Sanskrit shunyata with their character that means sky or space. And the Taoists would say, quoting Lao Tzu, the usefulness of a window is not so much in the frame as in the empty space through which something can be seen. The usefulness of a vase is not so much in the sides made of clay as in the hollow inside into which something can be put. And of course, that is a startling metaphor for a Westerner, because we think the other way round, you see. As I started out to say, we really think commonsensically that space is nothing at all. And we are much more sympathetic to the idea that it's pure abstraction than to the Oriental idea that space has some kind of basic reality. It bothers us, too, when astronomers talk about curved space. How can nothing be curved? Or properties of space? Or expanding space? How can it do that? And then when architects begin to talk about the functions of spaces, the commonsensical Westerner thinks, why don't they talk about the functions of walls? Of course, the walls enclose spaces, but the spaces of themselves have no function. And they're bothered about this. Painters also are very aware of space, because especially if you paint in oils, you have to paint your background. And therefore, in filling it in, you begin to realize that it has its own shape. It is the obverse of the foreground. And when you play with photographic negatives, or anything that switches foreground to background, foreground to background, you begin to become aware of space as having a shape. The interval between all sorts of objects becomes for you something significant, even though it's constantly flowing and changing, as indeed are the objects within the space. So it is a kind of a bit of a shock to our common sense, which in most cases has not caught up with 20th century physics or astronomy, to hear space considered as something effective, as something definitely there, so that you could say it has properties. Take another case of space, which is rather startling. There are different kinds of space. Space is basically, isn't it, an interval. There is an interval between each one of us sitting here. If we didn't have that, we would suffocate by being packed together like sardines. We need space in order to function as a human being. We need a kind of area in which to gesture and move and walk about and breathe and express ourselves. Now, you can have intervals not only in space but in time. Pauses are intervals. You can also have intervals in sound, the intervals between tones or notes. And the interesting thing about the intervals between tones is that they are that upon which the hearing of melody depends. Melody is hear. To hear melody is to hear intervals. Now, if you will simply visualize melody in terms of something graphic, supposing you represent a simple, say, introduction of a fugue. Or whatever, you know. You can see that in terms of a dancing line or a series of points at different levels representing, like musical notation, the high ones and the low ones. And you will recognize a pattern. But you see at once that the pattern depends on the way the critical dots in it are spaced. And it doesn't matter much whether the space is a big space or whether it's a little one, because it will always be relative to the size of the dots. You can magnify it or minify it, but you will see it is the way they are spaced that makes the difference. And here, once again, we are using spaced as a transitive verb now. We've talked about spaces or distances increasing, or people increasing a distance. And now we can talk about space as a verb, to space, to be spaced. And so, once again, the language is either playing tricks on us or else expressing a profound intuition. Language does both, and you have to watch out for which it is. Of course, it may be both. That is a possibility. But here at once you see, especially in that illustration of music, of it being necessary to hear intervals in order to hear melody, you see that the way things are spaced is really another way of talking about the way things are related. So you begin to realize that space is relationship. Go further now. There is another idea about space which is connected with both with all the Oriental uses of space. It is quite fundamental to Indian and a great deal of Chinese thinking that space equals consciousness. In other words, what actually we are experiencing as the all-inclusive space in which things happen is your mind. And your mind, of course, is not something inside your head. That is a great mistake to make. Your head is something in your mind. We can define a person's mind in many ways, but beginning with something rather simple, mind is occupied with thinking. Most people think in words, and you didn't get words out of your head. You got them from the community in which you live and were brought up. So when you think in a language which your community gave you, you are not really thinking your own thoughts. It is very difficult indeed to have private thoughts, because when the very materials with which you think are public property, it shows what a vast influence the public has on you in the deepest recesses of your mind. It's therefore very difficult also to think freely, independently, because we are pushed around with the symbolic systems of words or of numbers in which we think. But since you see the functioning of the mind in the process of thinking depends upon an outside community, you begin to see that your mind is a network, of relationships. You think only in the context of an environment of people and of natural processes. So that you could say that your mind is at the very least a most complex network of present and past relationships stretching out to the very limit.